Tonight we want to look at maybe a little bit, we want to look at the idea of what actually worship is. And so worship can be defined in two big words. First of all, reverence, and second of all, adoration. But the text we want to turn to tonight is found in Mark's gospel. So if you can turn there with me, it's Mark chapter 12. And we're going to read from verse 28 together. Mark chapter 12 and verse 28. Is the sound all right? Should I change my microphone? I can hear a little bit of feedback. I think that's because I'm standing here tonight instead of over there. And so it's just got a little bit further to go. If it gets irritating, please just holler. All right. Cool. So Mark chapter 12, this particular story we're going to read appears in three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. If you've read those three Gospels, you'll notice there's a similarity between the three of them. They're grouped together often, and they're called the Synoptic Gospels. And all three of these Gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all tell of the story, slightly different way of telling it, but the emphasis and the idea of it is all the same. And in this particular account, in Mark's account, Jesus is a couple of days away from ultimately dying and being crucified on the cross. And leading up to that moment, he is in Jerusalem, and all of his enemies, all of the religious leaders who have been upset and who have been found themselves threatened by this rabbi who's arrived out of nowhere, are now quizzing him to try and trick him because they want to find a fault in him to enable themselves to have a reason to kill him. And so Mark tells the story of how various leaders come to try and put Jesus on the spot. And one of the questions that they bring in this particular account is the question of what is the most important commandment? Now, if you go and analyze the Old Testament, you'll discover that there are 613 direct commandments that God gave through Moses to the people of God. 613 direct commands. And so this question had all the possibility to become highly controversial. Which one of those 613 commandments is the most important one? And so the question was open-ended, and it was designed to kind of allow Jesus to go down a road that might enable them to point a finger at him or to undermine him or to trap him in some way. And so let's read together as one of the scribes comes to him. So from verse 28, one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well. So Jesus has just answered a particular group of people. He's answered their very tricky question well. So now someone else comes up and tries to ask another tricky question. And seeing that he answered them well, he asked them, which commandment is the most important of all? And Jesus answered, the most important is, hear, O Israel, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And the second is this, is you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And the scribes said to him, you are right, teacher. You have truly said that there is one, and there is no other besides him. And to love him with all your heart and with all your understanding and with all your strength, and to love one neighbor as oneself is much more than all the burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. And after that, no one dared ask him any more questions. When we talk about the topic of worship, I think we can very quickly begin to compartmentalize the idea of worship to purely singing songs and the use of instruments. Without a shadow of a doubt, that is a significant element of worship. And in the coming weeks, we will look at some of what it means and some of the reasons why we sing and some of the reasons we use instruments and the power of instruments and the power of singing verses. But to begin, we need to realize that at a far more fundamental level, worship begins with reverence and adoration. And the heart of a worshiper is described here by Jesus in this passage as someone who loves God with all of their heart, with all of their soul, and with all of their mind, and with all of their strength. It's a description of someone who is wholeheartedly devoted to God. So, first of all, let's look at the idea of reverence. To revere someone is to deeply respect someone. To have reverence for someone is to subject yourself to them. In the word proskuneo, which is the word worship in the Greek New Testament, literally means to kiss the hand of a sovereign. Or it means to bow down or to put your face low down. It's an act of humbling yourself to the object of your worship. It's a reverence. It's a deep respect. So if you've studied law, or if you've been in a court for any reason, if you've watched any of the trials on TV, you'll have seen that sometimes the magistrates are referred to as your worship. Has anyone ever heard that? From the Anglo-Saxon kind of days. And it's still used today. We say, your worship. And the first time I heard that, it sounded quite weird to me, because I'd always only considered worship to be something that happens in a religious space. But the word worship in the English language comes from the idea of worth-ship. Something that is worthy of adoration. Something that is worthy of reverence and respect and honor. And so when you bump into a magistrate in a coffee shop, you might call them by their name. And I know one of the magistrates that works here in the law courts, and I see her in the coffee shop every now and again. And I refer to her by her name. But if I was in her courts, it would be a sign of respect to refer to her as your worship. Because it's a way of showing reverence and adoration. It's a way of showing my submission to her and the role that she plays in that position of magistrate or judge. And so to revere something or to bow down to something is an act of surrender. It's an act of you coming before the object of your worship and surrendering your will, surrendering your desire, and subjecting yourself, subjecting all of who you are to the object of your worship. It's a way of revering and deeply respecting. And when we look at the life of Jesus, we see how he lived in this way towards his Father in heaven. We see how everything he did purely out of a revelation of what his Father wanted to do. And so there's some verses that we can just quickly look at together. John chapter 5, verse 19. So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing on his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, so the Son does likewise." So Jesus says that he only does what the Father tells him to do. He has surrendered his life. He has surrendered his will. He has surrendered his desires, and he only does that which the Father does. This is worship. This is reverence. John chapter 8, verse 28. So Jesus said to them, "When you've lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own authority, but speak just as the Father taught me." In Luke chapter 9, verse 51, and in John chapter 12, verse 16, we see how Jesus journeyed towards Jerusalem, even though he knew death was awaiting him. And in fact, one of his disciples says to his other disciples at that moment, "Let's just go with him and die in Jerusalem," because he's intent on going to Jerusalem. And the reason Jesus is going to Jerusalem is because that is where the Father is calling him. His entire life is one of surrender and reverence to the Father's will. His entire life is a life of worship. Luke chapter 22, verse 42, Jesus says, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." Surrender is the starting point of our worship. The surrender of our will. Remember, we've been talking about Jesus' yoke. Remember, we've been talking from Matthew chapter 11, how Jesus says to those who are weary, and labored and burdened. He says, come to me and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, okay? And you will find rest for your souls. The invitation from Jesus is to live as he lived that we might find true life. That's his invitation. And as we've learned about how he practiced silence and solitude, and so we've also learned how he studied and meditated on the scriptures, we are now coming into the place of learning how he acted in a total surrender of his entire life to the Father as an act of worship. And when we take on this lifestyle of Jesus, where worship is not just a Sunday thing, where worship is not just a song thing, but where worship is an absolute surrender of everything that we are, an absolute surrender, a loving of God with all of our heart, our soul, our mind, our strength. When worship is that, we take on the yoke of Jesus, which leads to a light and easy load, which leads to a life of joy. Personally, in my life, I grew up, I can almost say, always knowing God. It is the most incredible privilege to have grown up with a sense, even I can just, from a young age, I have just known God, and I've just had a sense of God's reality and God's presence in my life. But throughout my junior school and high school years, I was half-hearted. And in particular, my identity was very shaky. I received the nickname Brother because of my faith. And when I moved to Cape Town, as my brother says, Cape Townians don't know how to say brother, so they shortened it to Bruv. And one or two people here tonight still call me Bruv. But there was that side of me that everybody recognized and saw. But there was another side of me that was half-hearted in my devotion and half-hearted in my worship of God, half-hearted in my walking with God. And I came down to UCT to study. I'm the youngest of four children, and I wanted to do something different. I was tired of being the little Agar, and I wanted to come to university where none of my siblings had gone. And I was so happy when my brother chose to go to Stellenbosch, because it meant that UCT was all for me. And I didn't want to study in Afrikaans anyway. So I came to UCT, and God had a real plan for my life. Halfway through my first year of varsity, I was sitting in a church service, a church on Main. And up until that point, I had really been enjoying church. I had really been enjoying meeting and interacting and worshiping and lifting my hands. But at the same time, I'd been really giving my life to other things at the same time. I was drinking a lot. Worst of all, I was talking filthy, foul stuff, making horrific comments and jokes purely to create some form of attention towards myself. And so I had this Friday night life. There was no kind of pools of Thursdays back then. It was Friday was the, you know, that was the night that the students would go out. So there was this Friday night life and this life that I had with my school friends that were in res with me. And then there was the Sunday and this midweek home group night life, you know. And this I was living two very separate lives. And it was in many ways tiring and hard. And a little bit into my first year, on a Sunday night, in a crowd not much bigger than this, a deaconess in the life of our church stood up and gave a 15-minute message. It wasn't the full sermon for the night. Andrew preached another message after that. But after she preached, people were called to the front to respond. And she had 3 points, and every single one of her points hit me in the heart. And I came forward that night, and I broke down in tears. And I knew from that moment, despite the fact that I'd kind of always known God, I knew from that moment that I would never be the same. I knew from that moment that I was taking on a wholehearted lifestyle where from that moment there would be a wholehearted devotion, a reverence, a surrender of everything that I was to God. And that moment brought such liberty and freedom to me. I took on the yoke. I took on the easy yoke. The burdensome yoke was trying to please everyone else. The burdensome yoke was trying to live up to a worldly idea of who I should be. The easy yoke was to surrender my all, was to surrender my identity, was to surrender my personhood, who I was as a person, was to surrender all of that to Jesus. That was the easy yoke that I received on that night. And I want to invite any of you tonight who might find yourself in a place where you are not fully surrendered in your life to God, where there's parts and areas of your life that you know are not fully surrendered in the way that we see Jesus living, where absolutely everything about Jesus' life was about living according to the Father's will. Now, of course, that means the big decisions. And I think when we talk about God's will for our lives, we always default to the big decisions, right? We always default to, should I be married or should I be single? Should I work in Joburg or should I work in Cape Town? No, don't work in Joburg. Stay in Cape Town. There, I can answer that one for you. And of course, it does involve those big decisions. Of course, it does. We see in Jesus, it involved those big decisions, right? He had to know when to go to Jerusalem. He had to know when to begin his ministry. Absolutely, it does involve those big decisions. But what we don't see is that the surrender of our will starts off in the small, mundane things, like the surrender of our time, like the surrender of our opinion, like the surrender of our voice or our idea, the surrender of our finances, the surrender of our identity. And it's in these more general surrenders, it's in these more general giving overs that we find ourselves coming into an intimate living relationship with Jesus that brings us into a place of knowing His will for the bigger decisions in our lives. And so the first topic we've looked at tonight is this idea of reverence, which really I think can be summed up with this idea of humility. To worship God is to humble ourselves before Him and to surrender and to let go and to pay homage to Him and to bow down. In fact, when you look at the word worship in the Bible, you'll see it often goes hand in hand with a person physically bowing down. We read in the book of Revelation, the final book in the Bible, when John sees a vision of an angel, he bows down to worship the angel. The angel says, no, don't worship me, worship God alone. But John assumes that posture because the word worship, proskuneia, literally means to bow down, to revere, to deeply respect, which means to subject yourself, which means to surrender yourself. That is worship. To surrender, to subject, to lay down your life. But the second part of worship is adoration. You see, you can walk into a court and you can call a judge your worship. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you love them. Doesn't necessarily mean that you adore them. The second element of worship is the element that Jesus speaks of here in Mark chapter 12 when he says that the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And what Jesus is getting to in that moment is he is saying that we are to love God with all that we are, with everything that we have. That we are to love Him with every ounce of energy. Let me see if I can find this in my notes here. Charles Spurgeon says this regarding this idea of loving God with your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. He says, our love must be sincere because it's with our heart. Our love must be intelligent because it's with our mind. Our love must be emotional because it's with our soul. Our love must be intense and energetic because it's with our strength. Basically, the idea is that we are to love God with everything, with our whole being, with all that we are, with our emotions, with our will, with our deep convictions, with our mind, with our energy, with everything that we have, with all of our possessions and everything under our control. We are to love Him with everything. We are to be wholehearted in our love towards Him. And you see, true worship starts from the inside. There is an overflow of instruments. There is an overflow of loving others. And Jesus gets to that because that's the second commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. But true worship begins on the inside with a love for God from the heart, and it overflows into song, and it overflows into action, into love towards others. You see, worship is personal and intimate. When you love, it's intimate. We experience intimate moments with friends. We experience moments of knowing each other, of sharing stories with each other, of praying with each other, of sometimes holding each other. We experience those intimate moments of love. And worship is an adoration, which is a moment of love and intimacy. And so our worship is an act of love, an act of adoration. I'm trying to find, that's awkward. I'm going to take a drink of water. So far we've looked at these two big ideas, that worship is adoration, and worship is, before that, reverence. And I just want to conclude with this thought, that Jesus is our substitute. You see, tonight, I think that the best place to start is to be honest with ourselves and to accept that it's really hard to do this. In fact, who of us here tonight can actually do this? Who of us here tonight can love God with all of our strength, with all of our might, with all of our mind? One of my favorite definitions for sin comes from Martin Lloyd-Jones. And Martin Lloyd-Jones defines sin as anything that does not come from a heart fully devoted to God. Sin is anything that does not love God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your might, with all of your strength. In other words, anything that we do that doesn't come from a place of absolute devotion to Jesus, that anything that we do that doesn't come from a place of worship and adoration and complete love, all right, is sin. Which means that who of us here tonight can actually love Jesus like this? Who of us here tonight can love God like this? And the irony is that in order for us to love God well, we have to begin by recognizing that it's impossible for us to love Him completely and receive His love for us first. And in a place of receiving His love for us, we respond with love for Him. Let me explain it this way. My daughter Rachel has been asking me and Lauren for a while, what is the difference between our God and other gods? And she has a number of friends that have other faiths, and so it's a real question for her little eight-year-old mind. And we answer her in the best ways that we can when she asks those questions. One day, a few weeks ago, she came home and she said, Dad. She said, Dad, I've been learning about this other faith at school, and when you break a fast and you shouldn't break it, when you eat food when you shouldn't be eating food, in order to make yourself right, in order to put yourself back in the right place, you have to go and feed 60 people on the street. You have to go and feed 60 people out there who don't have food to make up for the fact that you have sinned. And as she said this to me, I realized that I had an opportunity to really rattle her little mind and to show her what the grace of God is really like. And I said, you know, Rachel, that's amazing. But you know what's different about Jesus? Is that when you break a fast, or when you sin, or when you say something wrong, Jesus says, Rachel, I'll pay the price for you. In fact, Jesus says, Rachel, you are unable to feed 60 people with a pure heart. The biggest problem, Rachel, is that you have a hard heart. And I love you. And I will pay the price for you. I will do what you should have done. I will absorb the punishment you should have received. And I saw her little head begin to understand what the love of Jesus is truly like. And I said, you know, Rachel, if you ever want to question what the difference is between Jesus and any other system of trying to get to God, and I'm purposefully not mentioning it, the religion, you probably know which religion I'm talking about, but I'm purposefully not mentioning it because many Christians live in the same way. Many Christians think that in order to receive from God, they need to do, they need to act. You see, the greatest problem with that is that we're acting selfishly. We're feeding those 60 people so that we can be free. And Jesus wants us to love our neighbors, not to get something back, but to love them purely out of love. And the only way that we're able to love them purely out of love is if we have received His love that liberates us, that sets us free, and then we're able to love in freedom. And we're able to feed 60, 100, 10, however many people you feel called to feed, out of love, and not because you need to get something back from it. You see, Jesus is your substitute tonight. You can't love God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, with all of your strength. And when you break a fast when you shouldn't, or when you say something that you shouldn't, or when your mind wanders and does something that you know isn't worship, that you know isn't adoration, that you know isn't reverence to God, you don't have to go and appease God by doing something. You merely have to come back to His love and acceptance of you and find yourself whole in His love. And that's why John puts it this way in 1 John chapter 4. He says, this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. This is love, not that we love God, no, that He loved us. This is love, not that we love. He loved us. He came and loved us and saved us and died for us and lived the perfect life and died in our place. When we were unable to love Him, He did that. And when we receive that love, we're then able to respond with love. It's so counterintuitive. In order to love God the best that you can, you need to realize that your love is imperfect. And despite your imperfect ability to love Him, He has loved you unconditionally. And that love that you receive in your heart will spark in you the most incredible love, to love Him and to worship Him and to serve Him. I'm going to call the band up tonight because we want to give some time to singing now. Over the last 10 years, I have some regrets. I have some regrets around, particularly around some financial decisions that I've made. I have some regrets around some other decisions I've made. But one of the things that I do not regret is that moment when I surrendered my will to Jesus when I was a 19-year-old young man. One of the things I do not regret of the last 10, 15 years of my life is that I have, with the help of God and with the love of God, found myself surrendered to His will. And so my question to us tonight is, friends, what are we going to worship this week? Who are we going to sing our songs to? Who are you going to worship this week? Who are you going to worship as you leave here tonight? It might be that you have some regrets in the future, but let it not be that you worship the wrong thing. Let it not be that you revered the wrong God. Let it not be that you adored the wrong God. Let it be that you worshiped Him and him alone.